Part 2. Certain Dark Things. I love you as one loves certain dark things. Pablo Neruda, Sonnet 17. Chapter 8. Fire Tests Gold. Maya had never been to Long Island, but when she thought of it at all, she'd always thought of it as being a lot like New Jersey, mostly suburban, a place where people who worked in New York or Philly actually lived. She had dropped her bag into the back of Jordan's truck, startlingly unfamiliar. He'd driven a beaten-up red Toyota when they'd been dating, and it had always been littered with old, crumpled coffee cups and fast food bags, the ashtray full of cigarettes smoked down to the filter. The cab of this truck was comparatively clean, the only detritus a stack of papers on the passenger seat. He moved them aside with no comment as she climbed in. They hadn't spoken through Manhattan and onto the Long Island Expressway, and eventually Maya had dozed, her cheek against the cool glass of the window. She'd finally woken when they'd gone over a bump in the road, jolting her forward. She'd blinked, rubbing at her eyes. "Sorry," Jordan had said ruefully. "I was going to let you sleep until we got there." She'd sat up, looking around. They'd been driving down a two-lane blacktop road, the sky around them just beginning to lighten. There were fields on either side of the road, the occasional farmhouse or silo, clapboard houses set far back with picket fences around them. "It's pretty," she said in surprise. "Yeah." Jordan had changed gears, clearing his throat. "Since you're up anyway, before we get to the preacher house, can I show you something?" She'd hesitated only a moment before nodding. And now here they were, bumping down a one-lane dirt road, trees on either side. Most were leafless. The road was muddy, and Maya cranked the window down to smell the air. Trees, salt water, softly decaying leaves, small animals running through the high grass. She took another deep breath just as they bumped off the road and onto a small circular turnaround space. In front of them was the beach, stretching down to dark steel-blue water. The sky was almost lilac. She looked over at Jordan. He was staring straight ahead. "I used to come here while I was training at the Preter House," he said. "Sometimes just to look at the water and clear my head. The sun rises here. Every one is different, but they're all beautiful." "Jordan?" He didn't look at her. "Yeah? I'm sorry about before, about running off, you know, in the Navy Yard." "It's fine." He let his breath out slowly, but she could tell by the tension in his shoulders, his hand gripping the gear shift, that it wasn't. Not really. She tried not to look at the way the tension shaped the muscles in his arm, accenting the indentation of his biceps. "It was a lot for you to take in. I get that. I think we should take it slow. Work toward being friends." "I don't want to be friends," he said. She couldn't hide her surprise. "You don't?" He moved his hands from the gear shift to the steering wheel. Warm air poured from the heater inside the car, mixing with the cooler air outside Maya's open window. "We shouldn't talk about this now." "I want to," she said. "I want to talk about it now. I don't want to be stressing about us when we're in the Preter House." He slid down in his seat, chewing his lip. His tangled brown hair fell forward over his forehead. "Maya, if you don't want to be friends, then what are we? Enemies again?" He turned his head, his cheek against the back of the car seat. Those eyes, they were just as she remembered, hazel with flecks of green and blue and gold. "I don't want to be friends," he said, "because I still love you. Maya, you know, I haven't even so much as kissed anyone since we broke up." Isabel wanted to get drunk and talk about Simon. He took his hands off the steering wheel, reached for her, then dropped them back into his lap, a defeated look on his face. "I've only ever loved you. Thinking about you got me through my training. The idea that I might be able to make it up to you someday, and I will, in any way that I can, except for one. you won't be my friend. I won't be just your friend. I love you, Maya. I'm in love with you. I always have been. I always will be. Just being your friend would kill me. She looked out toward the ocean. The rim of the sun was just showing above the water, its rays lighting the sea in shades of purple and gold and blue. It's so beautiful here. That's why I used to come here. I couldn't sleep. I'd watch the sun come up. His voice was soft. Can you sleep now? She turned back to him. He closed his eyes. Maya, if you're going to say no, you don't want to be anything but friends with me. Just say it. Rip the band-aid off, okay? He looked braced, as if for a blow. His eyelashes cast shadows on his cheekbones. There were pale white scars on the olive skin of his throat, scars she had made. She unclipped her seatbelt and scooted across the bench seat toward him. She heard his gasp of breath, but he didn't move as she leaned in and kissed his cheek. She inhaled the scent of him. Same soap, same shampoo, but no lingering scent of cigarettes. Same boy. She kissed across his cheek, to the corner of his mouth, and finally, edging even closer, set her mouth over his. His lips opened under hers and he growled, low in his throat. Werewolves weren't gentle with each other, but his hands were light on her as he lifted her and set her on his lap, wrapping his arms around her as their kiss deepened. The feel of him, the warmth of his corduroy-covered arms around her, the beat of his heart, the taste of his mouth, the clash of his lips, teeth, and tongue stole her breath. Her hands slipped around the back of his neck, and she melted against him as she felt the soft, thick curls of his hair, exactly the same as it had always been. When they finally drew apart, his eyes were glassy. I've been waiting for that for years. She traced the line of his collarbone with a finger. She could feel her own heart beating. For a few moments, they hadn't been two werewolves on a mission to a deadly secret organization. They'd been two teenagers, making out in a car on the beach. Did it live up to your expectations? It was much better. His mouth crooked up at the corner. Does this mean... Well, she said, that's not the sort of thing you do with your friends, right? Isn't it? I'll have to tell Simon. He's going to be seriously disappointed. Jordan! She hit him lightly in the shoulder, but she was smiling, and so was he. An uncharacteristically big, goofy grin spreading over his face. She bent close and put her face against the crook of his neck, breathing him in along with the morning. They were battling across the frozen lake, the icy city glowing like a lamp in the distance. The angel with the golden wings and the angel with the wings like black fire. Clary stood on the ice as blood and feathers fell around her. The golden feathers burned like fire where they touched her skin, but the black feathers were as cold as ice. Clary awoke with her heart pounding, tangled in a knot of blankets. She sat up, pushing the blankets to her waist. She was in an unfamiliar room. The walls were white plaster, and she was lying in a bed made of black wood, still wearing the clothes she'd worn the night before. She slid out of bed, her bare feet hitting the cold stone floor, and looked around for her backpack. She found it easily, propped on a black leather chair. There were no windows in the room. The only light came from a pendant glass light fixture overhead made of cut black glass. She swept her hand through the pack and realized to her annoyance, although without surprise, that someone had already gone through the contents. Her art box was gone, including her steely. All that remained was her hairbrush and a change of jeans and underwear. At least the gold ring was still on her finger. She touched it lightly and thought at Simon. I'm in. Nothing. Simon? There was no response. She swallowed back her uneasiness. She had no idea where she was, what time it was, or how long she'd been out cold. Simon could be asleep. She couldn't panic and assume the rings didn't work. She had to go on autopilot, check out where she was, learn what she could. She'd try Simon again later. She took a deep breath and tried to focus on her immediate surroundings. Two doors led off the bedroom. She tried the first, and found that it opened onto a small glass and chrome bathroom with a copper claw-footed bathtub. There were no windows in here either. She showered quickly and dried herself with a fluffy white towel, then changed into clean jeans and a sweater before padding back into the bedroom, picking up her shoes and trying the second door. Bingo. Here was the rest of the... house? Apartment? She was in a large room, half of which was devoted to a long glass table. More of the black pendant-cut glass lights hung from the ceiling, sending dancing shadows against the walls. Everything was very modern, from the black leather chairs to the large fireplace, framed in washed chrome. There was a fire blazing in it. So someone else must be home, or must have been very recently. The other half of the room was taken up with a large television screen, a glossy black coffee table on which were scattered games and controllers, and low leather couches. A set of glass stairs led upward in a spiral. After a glance around, Clary began to climb them. The glass was perfectly clear and lent the impression that she was climbing an invisible staircase into the sky. The second floor was much like the first. Pale walls, black floor, a long corridor with doors opening off it. The first door led into what was clearly a master bedroom. A huge rosewood bed, hung with gauzy white curtains, took up most of the space. There were windows in here, tinted a dark blue. Clary went across the room to look out. She wondered for a moment if she was back in Alicante. She was looking across a canal at another building, its windows covered in closed green shutters. The sky above was gray, the canal a dark greenish blue, and there was a bridge visible just at her right, crossing the canal. Two people were standing on the bridge. One of them held a camera to his face and was industriously taking photos. Not Alicante, then. Amsterdam? Venice? She looked everywhere for a way to open the window, but there didn't appear to be one. She banged on the glass and shouted, but the bridge crossers took no notice. After a few moments, they moved on. Clary turned back into the bedroom and went to one of the wardrobes and threw it open. Her heart skipped a beat. The wardrobe was full of clothes, women's clothes, gorgeous dresses, lace and satin and beads and flowers. The drawers held camisoles and underwear, tops in cotton and silk, skirts but no jeans or pants. There were even shoes lined up, sandals and heels, and folded pairs of stockings. For a moment she just stared, wondering if there were another girl staying here, or if Sebastian had taken to cross-dressing. But the clothes all had the tags on them, and all of them were near her size. Not only that, she realized slowly, staring, they were exactly the shapes and colors that would suit her. Blues and greens and yellows, cut for a petite frame. Eventually, she drew out one of the simpler tops, a dark green cap-sleeved blouse with silk lacing up the front. After discarding her worn top on the floor, she shrugged the blouse on and glanced at the mirror hanging inside the wardrobe. It fit perfectly, made the most of her small figure clinging to her waist, darkening the green of her eyes. She yanked the tag off, not wanting to see how much it had cost, and hurried out of the room, feeling a shiver run down her spine. The next room was clearly Jace's. She knew it the minute she walked in. It smelled like him, like the cologne and soap and the scent of his skin. The bed was ebonized wood with white sheets and blankets, perfectly made. It was as neat as his room at the Institute. Books were stacked by his bed, the titles in Italian and French and Latin. The silver Herondale dagger with its pattern of birds was jammed into the plaster wall. When she looked closer, she could see that it was pinning a photograph in place, a photograph of herself and Jace, taken by Izzy. She remembered it, a clear day in early October, Jace, sitting on the front steps of the Institute, a book on his lap. She was sitting a step above him, her hand on his shoulder, leaning forward to see what he was reading. His hand covered hers, almost absently, and he was smiling. She hadn't been able to see his face that day, hadn't known he was smiling like that, not until now. Her throat contracted, and she went out of the room, catching her breath. She couldn't act like this, she told herself sternly, as if each sight of Jace the way he was now was a sucker punch to the gut. She had to pretend that it didn't matter, as if she noticed no difference. She went into the next room, another bedroom, much like the one before it, but this one was a mess, the bed a tangle of black silk sheets and comforter, a glass and steel desk covered with books and papers, boy clothes scattered everywhere, jeans and jackets and t-shirts and gear. Her eye fell on something that gleamed silver, propped on the nightstand near the bed. She moved forward, staring, unable to believe her eyes. It was the small box of her mother's, the one with the initials J.C. on it, the one her mother used to take out every year, once a year, and weep over silently, the tears running down her face to splash onto her hands. Clary knew what was in the box. A lock of hair, as fine and white as dandelion fluff, scraps from a child's shirt, a baby shoe, small enough to fit inside the palm of her hand, bits and pieces of her brother, a sort of collage of the child her mother had wanted to have, had dreamed of having, before Valentine had done what he had and turned his own son into a monster. J.C. Jonathan Christopher. Her stomach twisted, and she backed up quickly out of the room, directly into a wall of living flesh. Arms came around her, wrapping her tight, and she saw that they were slim and muscular, downed with fine pale hair. And for a moment, she thought it was Jace holding her. She began to relax. "What were you doing in my room?" Sebastian said into her ear. Isabel had been trained to wake up early every morning, rain or shine, and a slight hangover did nothing to prevent it from happening again. She sat up slowly and blinked down at Simon. She'd never spent an entire night in a bed with anyone else, unless you counted crawling into her parents' bed when she was 4 and afraid of thunderstorms. She couldn't help staring at Simon as if he were some exotic species of animal. He lay on his back, his mouth slightly open, his hair in his eyes. Ordinary brown hair, ordinary brown eyes. His t-shirt was pulled up slightly. He wasn't muscular like a shadow hunter. He had a smooth, flat stomach, but no six-pack, and there was still a hint of softness to his face. What was it about him that fascinated her? He was plenty cute, but she had dated gorgeous fairy knights, sexy shadow hunters. "Isabel," Simon said without opening his eyes, "quit staring at me." Isabel sighed irritably and swung herself out of bed. She rummaged in her bag for her gear, retrieved it, and headed out to find the bathroom. It was halfway down the hall, and the door was just opening, Alec emerging in a cloud of steam. He had a towel around his waist and another around his shoulders, and was rubbing energetically at his wet black hair. Isabel supposed she shouldn't be surprised to see him. He'd been trained to wake up early in the morning just like she had. "You smell like sandalwood," she said by way of greeting. She hated the smell of sandalwood. She liked sweet scents. Vanilla, cinnamon, gardenia. Alec looked at her. "We like sandalwood." Isabel made a face. "Either that's the royal we, or you and Magnus are turning into one of those couples that think they're one person. We like sandalwood. We adore the symphony. We hope you enjoy our Christmas present, which, if you ask me, is just a cheap way of avoiding having to buy two gifts." Alec blinked wet lashes at her. "You'll understand. If you tell me I'll understand when I'm in love, I'll smother you with that towel. And if you keep preventing me from going back to my room and getting dressed, I'll get Magnus to summon up pixies to tie your hair in knots." "Oh, get out of my way," Isabel kicked at Alec's ankle until he moved, unhurriedly, down the hall. She had the feeling if she turned around and looked at him, he'd be sticking his tongue out at her, so she didn't look. Instead, she locked herself in the bathroom and turned on the shower full steam. Then she looked at the rack of shower products and said an unladylike word. Sandalwood shampoo, conditioner, and soap. Ugh. When she finally emerged, dressed in her gear and with her hair up, she found Alec, Magnus, and Jocelyn waiting for her in the living room. There were donuts, which she didn't want, and coffee, which she did. She poured a liberal amount of milk into it and sat back, looking at Jocelyn, who was also dressed, to Isabel's surprise, in Shadowhunter gear. It was odd, she mused. People often told her she looked like her mother, though she didn't see it herself, and she wondered now if it was in the same way that Clary looked like Jocelyn. The same color hair, yes, but also the same cast of features. The same tilt of the head, the same stubborn set to the jaw, the same sense that this person might look like a porcelain doll, but was steel underneath. Although, Isabel wished that, in the same way that Clary had gotten her mother's green eyes, she'd gotten Maris and Robert's blue ones. Blue was so much more interesting than black. As with the Silent City, there is only one adamant citadel. But there are many doors through which one may find it, said Magnus. The closest to us is the old Augustinian monastery on Grimes Hill in Staten Island. Alec and I will portal with you there and wait for you to return, but we can't go with you all the way. I know, said Isabel, because you're boys. Cooties. Alec pointed a finger at her. Take this seriously, Isabel. The Iron Sisters aren't like the Silent Brothers. They're way less friendly, and they don't like being bothered. I promise I'll be on my best behavior, Isabel said, and set her empty coffee mug down on the table. Let's go. Magnus looked at her suspiciously for a moment, then shrugged. His hair was gelled up today into a million sharp points, and his eyes were smudged with black, making them look more cat-like than ever. He moved past her to the wall, already murmuring in Latin, the familiar outline of a portal, its arcane door shaped outlined with glittering symbols, began to take form. Wind rose, cool and sharp, blowing back the tendrils of Isabel's hair. Jocelyn stepped forward first and walked through the portal. It was a little like watching someone disappear into the side of a wave of water. A silvery haze seemed to swallow her in, dulling the color of her red hair as she vanished into it with a faint shimmer. Isabel went next. She was used to the stomach-dropping feeling of transportation by portal. There was a soundless roar in her ears and no air in her lungs. She closed her eyes, then opened them again as the whirlwind released her and she fell into dry brush. She rose to her feet, brushing dead grass from her knees, and saw Jocelyn looking at her. Clary's mother opened her mouth and closed it again as Alec appeared, dropping into the vegetation beside Isabel, and then Magnus, the shimmering half-seen portal closing behind him. Even the trip through the portal had not disarranged Magnus's hair spikes. He tugged on one proudly. Check it out, he said to Isabel. Magic? Hair gel, $3.99 at Ricky's. Isabel rolled her eyes at him and turned to take in her new surroundings. They stood atop a hill, its peak covered in dry brush and withered grass. Lower down were autumn-blackened trees, and in the far distance, Isabel saw cloudless sky and the top of the Verrazano Narrows Bridge connecting Staten Island to Brooklyn. As she turned, Isabel saw the monastery behind her, rising out of the dull foliage. It was a large building of red brick, most of its windows smashed out or boarded over. It was tagged here and there with graffiti. Turkey vultures, disturbed by the traveler's arrival, circled the dilapidated bell tower. Isabel squinted at it, wondering if there was a glamour to be peeled off. If so, it was a strong one. Try as she might, she couldn't see anything but the ruinous building before her. There's no glamour, said Jocelyn, startling Isabel. What you see is what you get. Jocelyn trudged toward it, her boots crushing down the dry vegetation in front of her. After a moment, Magnus shrugged and followed her, and Isabel and Alec came after. There was no path. Branches grew in tangles, dark against the clear air, and the foliage underfoot crackled with dryness. As they neared the building, Isabel saw that patches of the dry grass were burned away where pentagrams and runic circles had been spray-painted into the grass. "Mundanes," said Magnus, lifting a branch out of Isabel's way. "Playing their little games with magic, not really understanding it. They're often drawn to places like this, centers of power, without really knowing why. They drink and hang out and spray-paint the walls like you could leave a human mark on magic. You can't." They had reached a boarded-up door in the brick wall. "We're here." Isabel looked hard at the door. Again, there was no sense that a glamour covered it, although if she concentrated hard, a faint shimmer grew visible, like sunshine glancing off water. A look passed between Jocelyn and Magnus. Jocelyn turned to Isabel. "You're ready?" Isabel nodded, and without further ado, Jocelyn stepped forward and vanished through the boards of the door. Magnus looked expectantly at Isabel. Alec leaned closer to her, and she felt the brush of his hand on her shoulder. "Don't worry," he said. "You'll be fine, Iz." She raised her chin. "I know," she said, and followed Jocelyn through the door. Clary sucked in her breath. But before she could reply, there was a step on the stairs, and Jace appeared at the end of the hallway. Sebastian immediately let her go and spun her around. With a smile like a wolf's, he ruffled her hair. "Good to see you, little sister." Clary was speechless. Jace, though, wasn't. He moved toward them soundlessly. He was wearing a black leather jacket, a white t-shirt and jeans, and was barefoot. "Were you hugging Clary?" He looked at Sebastian in amazement. Sebastian shrugged. "She's my sister. I'm pleased to see her." "You don't hug people," Jay said. "I ran out of time to bake a casserole." "It was nothing," Clary said, waving a dismissive hand at her brother. "I tripped. He was just keeping me from falling over." If Sebastian was surprised to hear her defend him, he didn't show it. He was expressionless as she moved across the corridor towards Jace, who kissed her on the cheek, his fingers cool against her skin. "What were you doing up here?" Jace asked. "Looking for you," she shrugged. "I woke up and couldn't find you. I thought maybe you were asleep." "I see you discovered the clothes stash." Sebastian indicated her shirt with a gesture. "Do you like them?" Jace shot him a look. "We were out getting food," he said to Clary. "Nothing fancy, bread and cheese. You want lunch?" Which was how, several minutes later, Clary found herself installed at the big glass and steel table. From the comestibles spread out over the table, she figured that her second guest had been right. They were in Venice. There was bread, Italian cheeses, salami and prosciutto, grapes and fig jam, and bottles of Italian wine. Jay sat across from her, Sebastian at the head of the table. She was eerily reminded of the night she had met Valentine at Renwick's in New York. How he had put himself between Jace and Clary at the head of the table. How he had offered them wine and told them they were brother and sister. She sneaked a glance at her real brother now. She thought of how her mother had looked when she'd seen him. Valentine. But Sebastian wasn't a carbon copy of their father. She had seen pictures of Valentine when he was their age. Sebastian's face tempered her father's hard features with her mother's prettiness. He was tall, but less broad-shouldered, more lithe and cat-like. He had Jocelyn's cheekbones and fine, soft mouth, Valentine's dark eyes and white blonde hair. He looked up then, as if he had caught her staring at him. "Wine?" he offered the bottle. She nodded. Though she had never much liked the taste of wine, and since Renwick's, she had hated it. She cleared her throat as Sebastian filled the glass, So, she said, this place, is it yours? It was our father's, said Sebastian, setting the bottle down. Valentine's. It moves in and out of worlds, ours and others. He used to use it as a retreat, as well as a mode of travel. He brought me here a few times, showed me how to get in and out, and how to make it travel. There's no front door. There is if you know how to find it, said Sebastian. Dad was very clever about this place. Clary looked at Jace, who shook his head. He never showed it to me. I wouldn't have guessed it existed either. It's very bachelor pad, Clary said. I wouldn't have thought of Valentine as... Owning a flat-screen TV? Jace grinned at her. Not that it gets channels, but you can watch DVDs on it. Back at the manor, we had an old icebox powered by witchlight. Here he's got a sub-zero fridge. That was for Jocelyn, said Sebastian. Clary looked up. What? All the modern stuff, the appliances, and the clothes. Like that shirt you're wearing, they were for our mother, in case she decided to come back. Sebastian's dark eyes met hers. She felt a little sick. This is my brother, and we're talking about our parents. She felt dizzy. Too much happening too fast to take in, to process. She had never had time to think about Sebastian as her living, breathing brother. By the time she'd found out who he really was, he'd been dead. Sorry if it's weird, Jay said apologetically, indicating her shirt. We can buy you some other clothes. Clary touched the sleeve lightly. The fabric was silky, fine, expensive. Well, that explained that. Everything close to her size, everything in colors that suited her. Because she looked just like her mother. She took a deep breath. It's fine, she said. It's just... What do you do exactly? Just travel around inside this apartment and... See the world? Jay said lightly. There's worse things. But you can't do that forever. Sebastian hadn't eaten much, but he drank 2 glasses of wine. He was on his third, and his eyes were glittering. Why not? Well, because. Because the Clave is looking for both of you, and you can't spend forever running and hiding. Clary's voice trailed off as she looked from one of them to the other. They were sharing a look. The look of 2 people who knew something, together, that no one else did. It was not a look Jace had shared with someone else in front of her in a very long time. Sebastian spoke softly and slowly. Are you asking a question or making an observation? She has a right to know our plans, Jace said. She came here knowing she couldn't go back. A leap of faith, said Sebastian, running his finger around the rim of his glass. It was something Clary had seen Valentine do. In you. She loves you. That's why she's here, isn't it? So what if it is? Clary said. She supposed she could pretend there was another reason, but Sebastian's eyes were dark and sharp, and she doubted he'd believe her. I trust Jace. But not me, Sebastian said. Clary chose her next words with extreme care. If Jace trusts you, then I want to trust you, she said. And you're my brother. That counts for something. The lie tasted bitter in her mouth. But I don't really know you. Then maybe you should spend a little time getting to know me, Sebastian said. And then we'll tell you our plans. We'll tell you. Our plans. In his mind, there was a him and Jace. There was no Jace and Clary. I don't like keeping her in the dark, Jace said. We'll tell her in a week. What difference does a week make? Jace gave him a look. 2 weeks ago, you were dead. Well, I wasn't suggesting 2 weeks, said Sebastian. That would be insane. Jace's mouth quirked up at the corner. He looked at Clary. I'm willing to wait for you to trust me, she said, knowing it was the right, smart thing to say, hating to say it. However long it takes. A week, Jace said. A week, agreed Sebastian. And that means she stays here in the apartment, no communication with anyone. No unlocking the door for her, no going in and out. Jace leaned back. What if I'm with her? Sebastian gave him a long look from under lowered eyelashes. His look was calculating. He was deciding what he was going to allow Jace to do, Clary realized. He was deciding how much leash to give his brother. Fine, he said at last, his voice rich with condescension. If you're with her. Clary looked down at her wine glass. She heard Jace reply in a murmur but couldn't look at him. The idea of a Jace who was allowed to do things. Jace, who always did whatever he wanted, made her sick to her stomach. She wanted to get up and smash the wine bottle over Sebastian's head, but she knew it was impossible. Cut one and the other bleeds. How's the wine? It was Sebastian's voice, an undercurrent of amusement playing in his tone. She drained the glass, choking on the bitter flavor. Delicious. Isabel emerged in an alien landscape. A deep green plain swept out before her under a lowering gray-black sky. Isabel pulled up the hood of her gear and peered out, fascinated. She had never seen such a great, overarching expanse of sky, or such a vast plain. It was shimmering, jewel-toned, the shade of moss. As Isabel took a step forward, she realized it was moss, growing on and around the black rocks scattered across the coal-colored earth. It's a volcanic plain, Jocelyn said. She was standing beside Isabel, and the wind was pulling red-gold strands of her hair out of its tightly pinned bun. She looked so much like Clary that it was eerie. These were lava beds once. The whole area is probably volcanic to some degree. Working with Atomos, the sisters need incredible heat for their forges. You'd think it would be a little warmer then, Isabel muttered. Jocelyn cast her a dry look and started walking. In what seemed to Isabel a randomly chosen direction, she scrambled to follow. Sometimes you're so much like your mother, you astound me a little, Isabel. I take that as a compliment. Isabel narrowed her eyes. No one insulted her family. It wasn't meant as an insult. Isabel kept her eyes on the horizon, where the dark sky met the jewel-green ground. How well did you know my parents? Jocelyn gave her a quick sideways look. Well enough. When we were all in Idris together. I hadn't seen them for years until recently. Did you know them when they got married? The path Jocelyn was taking had begun to slant uphill, so her reply was slightly breathless. Yes. Were they in love? Jocelyn stopped short and turned to look at Isabel. Isabel, what is this about? Love? Isabel suggested after a moment's pause. I don't know why you'd think I'd be the expert on that. Well, you managed to keep Luke hanging around for his whole life, basically, before you agreed to marry him. That's impressive. I wish I had that kind of power over a guy. You do, said Jocelyn. Have it, I mean. And it isn't something to wish for. She pushed her hands up through her hair, and Isabel felt a little jolt. For all that Jocelyn looked like her daughter, her thin, long hands, flexible and delicate, were Sebastian's. Isabel remembered slicing one of those hands off in the valley in Idris, her whip cutting through skin and bone. Your parents aren't perfect, Isabel, because no one's perfect. They're complicated people, and they just lost a child. So if this is about your father staying in Idris... My father cheated on my mother! Isabel blurted out, and nearly covered her own mouth with her hand. She had kept the secret, kept it for years, and to say it out loud to Jocelyn seemed like a betrayal, despite everything. Jocelyn's face changed. It held sympathy now. I know. Isabel took a sharp breath. Does everyone know? Jocelyn shook her head. No, a few people. I was... in a privileged position to know. I can't say more than that. Who was it? Isabel demanded. Who did he cheat on her with? It was no one you know, Isabel.
You don't know who I know?
Isabel's voice rose. And stop saying my name that way, as if I'm a little kid.
It's not my place to tell you, Jocelyn said flatly, and began to walk again.
Isabel scrambled after her. Even as the path took a steeper turn upward, a wall of green rising to meet the thunderous sky.
I have every right to know. They're my parents, and if you don't tell me, I...
She stopped, inhaling sharply. They had reached the top of the ridge, and somehow, in front of them, a fortress had sprung like a fast-blooming flower out of the ground. It was carved of white silver adamas, reflecting the cloud-streaked sky. Towers topped with electrum reached toward the sky, and the fortress was surrounded by a high wall, also of adamas, in which was set a single gate, formed of two great blades plunged into the ground at angles, so that they resembled a monstrous pair of scissors.
The adamant citadel, said Jocelyn.
Thanks, Isabel snapped. I figured that out. Jocelyn made the noise that Isabel was familiar with from her own parents. Isabel was pretty sure it was parent speak for teenagers. Then Jocelyn started down the hill to the fortress. Isabel, tired of scrambling, stalked ahead of her. She was taller than Clary's mother and had longer legs, and saw no reason why she should wait for Jocelyn if the other woman was going to persist in treating her like a child. She stomped down the hill, crushing moss under her boots, ducked through the scissor-like gates, and froze. She was standing on a small outcropping of rock. In front of her, the earth dropped away into a vast chasm, at the bottom of which boiled a river of red-gold lava encircling the fortress. Across the chasm, much too far to jump, even for a shadow hunter, was the only visible entrance to the fortress, a closed drawbridge.
Some things, said Jocelyn at her elbow, are not as simple as they first appear.
Isabel jumped, then glared.
So not the place to sneak up on someone.
Jocelyn simply crossed her arms over her chest and raised her eyebrows. Surely Hodge taught you the proper method of approaching the Adamant Citadel, she said. After all, it is open to all female shadow hunters in good standing with the Clave.
Of course he did, said Isabel haughtily, scrambling mentally to remember.
Only those with Nephilim blood. She reached up and took one of the metal chopsticks from her hair. When she twisted its base, it popped and clicked and unfolded into a dagger with a rune of courage on the blade. Isabel raised her hand over the chasm.
Ignis aurum probat, she said,
and used the dagger to cut open her left palm. It was a swift, searing pain, and blood ran from the cut, a ruby stream that splattered into the chasm below. There was a flash of blue light and a creaking noise. The drawbridge was slowly lowering. Isabel smiled and wiped the blade of her knife on her gear. After another twist, it had become a slim metal chopstick again. She slid it back into her hair.
Do you know what that means? Asked Jocelyn, her eyes on the lowering bridge.
What? What you just said. The motto of the Iron Sisters. The drawbridge was almost flat.
It means fire tests gold.
Right, said Jocelyn.
They don't just mean forges and metalwork. They mean that adversity tests one's strength of character. In difficult times, in dark times, some people shine.
Oh yeah? Said Izzy. Well, I'm sick of dark and difficult times. Maybe I don't want to shine.
The drawbridge crashed at their feet.
If you're anything like your mother, said Jocelyn, you won't be able to help it.
Chapter 9 The Iron Sisters.
Alec raised the witchlight runestone high in his hand, brilliant light raying out from it, spotlighting now one corner of the City Hall station and then another. He jumped as a mouse squeaked, running across the dusty platform. He was a shadow hunter. He had been in many dark places,
but there was something about the abandoned air of this station that made a cold shiver run up his spine. Perhaps it was the chill of disloyalty he had felt, slipping away from his guard post on Staten Island and heading down the hill to the ferry the moment Magnus had left. He hadn't thought about what he was doing. He'd just done it, as if he were on autopilot. If he hurried, he was sure he could be back before Isabel and Jocelyn returned, before anyone realized he'd ever been gone. Alec raised his voice. "Camille!" he called. "Camille Belcour!" He heard a light laugh. It echoed off the walls of the station. Then she was there, at the top of the stairs, the brilliance of her witchlight rendering her a silhouette. "Alexander Lightwood," she said. "Come upstairs." She vanished. Alec followed his darting witchlight up the steps and found Camille where he had before, in the lobby of the station. She was dressed in the fashion of a bygone era, a long velvet dress nipped in at the waist, her hair dressed high in white blonde curls, her lips dark red. He supposed she was beautiful, though he wasn't the best judge of feminine appeal. And it didn't help that he hated her. "What's with the costume?" he demanded. She smiled. Her skin was very smooth and white, without dark lines. She had fed recently. "A masquerade ball downtown. I fed quite well. Why are you here, Alexander? Starved for good conversation?" If he were Jace, Alec thought, he'd have a smart remark for that. Some kind of pun or cleverly disguised put-down. Alec just bit his lip and said, "You told me to come back if I was interested in what you were offering." She ran a hand along the back of the divan, the only piece of furniture in the room. "And you've decided that you are." Alec nodded. She chuckled. "You understand what you are asking for." Alec's heart was pounding. He wondered if Camille could hear it. "You said you could make Magnus mortal, like me." Her full lips thinned. "I did," she said. "I must admit, I doubted your interest. You left rather hastily." "Don't play with me," he said. "I don't want what you're offering that badly."
"Liar," she said casually, "or you wouldn't be here."
She moved around the divan, coming close to him, her eyes raking his face.
"Up close," she said. "You do not look so much like Will as I had thought. You have his coloring, but a different shape to your face. Perhaps a slight weakness to your jaw."
"Shut up," he said. "Okay, it wasn't Jace-level wit, but it was something. I don't want to hear about Will."
"Very well," she stretched like a cat. "It was many years ago when Magnus and I were lovers. We were in bed together after quite a passionate evening."
She saw him flinch and grinned.
"You know how it is with pillow talk. One reveals one's weaknesses. Magnus spoke to me of a spell that existed, one that might be undertaken to rid a warlock of their immortality."
"So why don't I just find out what the spell is and do it?" Alec's voice rose and cracked. "Why do I need you?"
"First, because you're a shadow hunter. You've no idea how to work a spell," she said calmly. "Second, because if you do it, he'll know it was you. If I do it, he will assume it is revenge. Spite on my part, and I do not care what Magnus thinks, but you do."
Alec looked at her steadily. "And you're going to do this for me as a favor?" She laughed, like tinkling bells.
"Of course not," she said. "You do a favor for me, and I will do one for you. That is how these matters are conducted."
Alec's hand tightened around the witchlight runestone until the edges cut into his hand. "And what favor do you want from me?"
"It's very simple," she said. "I want you to kill Raphael Santiago."
The bridge that crossed the crevice surrounding the adamant citadel was lined with knives. They were sunk, point upward, at random intervals along the path, so that it was possible to cross the bridge only very slowly by picking your way with dexterity. Isabel had little trouble, but was surprised to see how lightly Jocelyn, who hadn't been an active shadow hunter in 15 years, made her way. By the time Isabel had reached the opposite side of the bridge, her dexteratus rune had vanished into her skin, leaving a faint white mark behind. Jocelyn was only a step behind her, and as aggravating as Isabel found Clary's mother, she was glad in a moment when Jocelyn raised her hand and a witch-like runestone blazed forth, illuminating the space they stood in. The walls were hewn from white-silver adamas, so that the dim light seemed to glow from within them. The floor was demon stone as well, and carved into the center of it was a black circle. Inside the circle, the symbol of the Iron Sisters was carved, a heart punctured through and through by a blade. Whispering voices made Isabel tear her gaze from the floor and look up. A shadow had appeared inside one of the smooth white walls, a shadow growing ever clearer, ever closer. Suddenly, a portion of the wall slid back and a woman stepped out. She wore a long, loose white gown, bound tightly at the wrists and under her breasts with silver white cord, demon wire. Her face was both unwrinkled and ancient. She could have been any age. Her hair was long and dark, hanging in a thick braid down her back. Across her eyes and temples was an intricately curly-cued tattooed mask encircling both her eyes, which were the orange color of leaping flames. "Who calls on the Iron Sisters?" she said. "Speak your names." Isabel looked toward Jocelyn, who gestured that she should speak first. She cleared her throat. "I am Isabel Lightwood, and this is Jocelyn Fairchild. We have come to ask your help."
"Jocelyn Morgenstern," said the woman. "Born Fairchild, but you cannot so easily erase the taint of Valentine from your past. Have you not turned your back on the Clave?"
"It is true," said Jocelyn. "I am an outcast. But Isabel is a daughter of the Clave. Her mother
runs the New York Institute," said the woman. "We are remote here, but not without sources of information. I am no fool. My name is Sister Cleophas, and I am a maker. I shape the adamas for the other sisters to carve. I recognize that whip you wind so cunningly around your wrist," she indicated Isabel. "As for that bubble around your throat."
"If you know so much," said Jocelyn, as Isabel's hand crept to the ruby at her neck, "then do you know why we are here? Why we have come to you?"
Sister Cleophas's eyelids lowered, and she smiled slowly.
"Unlike our speechless brethren, we cannot read minds here in the fortress. Therefore, we rely upon a network of information, most of it very reliable. I assume this visit has something to do with the situation involving Jace Lightwood, as his sister is here, and your son, Jonathan Morgenstern."
"We have a conundrum," said Jocelyn. "Jonathan Morgenstern plots against the Clave, like his father. The Clave has issued a death warrant against him. But Jace, Jonathan Lightwood, is very much loved by his family, who have done no wrong, and by my daughter. The conundrum is that Jace and Jonathan are bound by very ancient blood magic."
"Blood magic? What sort of blood magic?"
Jocelyn took Magnus's folded notes from the pocket of her gear and handed them over. Cleophas studied them with her intent, fiery gaze. Isabel saw with a start that the fingers of her hands were very long, not elegantly long, but grotesquely so, as if the bones had been stretched so that each hand resembled an albino spider. Her nails were filed to points, each tipped with electrum. She shook her head.
"The sisters have little to do with blood magic."
The flame color of her eyes seemed to leap and then dim. And a moment later, another shadow appeared behind the frosted glass surface of the adamas wall. This time, Isabel watched more closely as a second Iron Sister stepped through. It was like watching someone emerge from a haze of white smoke.
"Sister Dolores," said Cleophas, handing Magnus's note to the new arrival. She looked much like Cleophas, the same tall, narrow form, the same white dress, the same long hair, though in this case her hair was gray and bound at the ends of her two braids with gold wire. Despite her gray hair, her face was lineless, her fire-colored eyes bright.
"Can you make sense of this?"
Dolores glanced over the pages briefly.
"A twinning spell," she said. "Much like our own Parabatai ceremony, but its alliance is demonic."
"What makes it demonic?" Isabel demanded. "If the spell is harmless..."
"Is it?" said Cleophas, but Dolores shot her a quelling look.
"The Parabatai ritual binds two individuals, but leaves their wills free," Dolores explained. "This binds two, but makes one subordinate to the other. What the primary of the two believes, the other will believe. What the first one wants, the second will want. It essentially removes the free will of the secondary partner in the spell. And that is why it is demonic. For free will is what makes us heaven's creatures.
It also seems to mean that when one is wounded, the other is wounded," said Jocelyn.
"Might we presume the same about death?"
"Yes. Neither will survive the death of the other. This, again, is not part of our Parabatai ritual, for it is too cruel."
"Our question to you is this," said Jocelyn. "Is there any weapon forged, or that you might create, that could harm one but not the other? Or that might cut them apart?"
Sister Dolores looked down at the notes, then handed them to Jocelyn. Her hands, like those of her colleague, were long and thin and as white as floss.
"No weapon we have forged or could ever forge might do that."
Isabel's hand tightened at her side, her nails cutting into her palm.
"You mean there's nothing?"
"Nothing in this world," said Dolores.
"A blade of heaven or hell might do it. The sword of the Archangel Michael, that Joshua fought with at Jericho, for it is infused with heavenly fire, and there are blades forged in the blackness of the pit that might aid you. Though how one might be obtained, I do not know.
And we would be prevented from telling you by the law if we did know," said Cleophas with asperity.
"You understand, of course, that we will also have to tell the Clave about this visit of yours."
"What about Joshua's sword?" interrupted Isabel. "Can you get that? Or can we?"
"Only an angel can gift you that sword," said Dolores.
"And to summon an angel is to be blasted with heavenly fire."
"But Raziel," Isabel began.
Cleophas's lips thinned into a straight line.
"Raziel left us the mortal instruments that he might be called upon in a time of direst need. That one chance was wasted when Valentine summoned him. We shall never be able to compel his might again. It was a crime to use the instruments in that manner. The only reason that Clarissa Morganston escaped culpability is that it was her father who summoned him, not herself."
"My husband also summoned another angel," said Jocelyn. Her voice was quiet. "The angel Ithuriel. He kept him imprisoned for many years." Both sisters hesitated before Dolores spoke.
"It is the bleakest of crimes to entrap an angel," she said. "The Clave could never approve it. Even if you could summon one, you could never force it to do your bidding. There is no spell for that. You could never get an angel to give you the Archangel's sword. You can take by force from an angel, but there is no greater crime. Better that your Jonathan die than an angel be so besmirched."
At that, Isabel, whose temper had been rising, exploded.
"That's the problem with you, all of you, the Iron Sisters and the Silent Brothers. Whatever they do to change you from Shadowhunters to what you are, it takes all of the feelings out of you.
We might be part angel, but we're part human, too. You don't understand love, or the things people do for love, or family.
The flames leaped in Dolores's orange eyes.
I had a family, she said. A husband and children, all murdered by demons. There was nothing left to me. I had always had a skill with shaping things with my hands, so I became an Iron Sister. The peace it has brought me is peace I think I would never have found elsewhere. It is for that reason I chose the name Dolores, Sorrow. So do not presume to tell us what we do or do not know about pain or humanity.
You don't know anything, Isabel snapped. You're as hard as demon stone. No wonder you surround yourselves with it.
Fire tempers gold, Isabel Lightwood, said Cleophas.
Oh, shut up, Isabel said. You've been very unhelpful, both of you.
She turned on the heel of her boot, spun away, and stalked back across the bridge, barely taking note of where the knives turned the path into a death trap, letting her body's training guide her. She reached the other side and strode through the gates. Only when she was outside them did she break down. Kneeling among the moss and volcanic rocks, under the great gray sky, she let herself shake silently, though no tears came. It seemed ages before she heard a soft step beside her, and Jocelyn knelt and put her arms around her. Oddly, Isabel found that she didn't mind. Though she had never much liked Jocelyn, there was something so universally motherly in her touch that Isabel leaned into it, almost against her own will.
"Do you want to know what they said after you left?" Jocelyn asked, after Isabel's trembling had slowed.
"I'm sure something about how I'm a disgrace to shadow hunters everywhere, etc."
"Actually, Cleophas said you'd make an excellent Iron Sister, and if you were ever interested, to let them know."
Jocelyn's hand stroked her hair lightly. Despite everything, Isabel choked back a laugh. She looked up at Jocelyn.
"Tell me," she said.
Jocelyn's hand stopped moving.
"Tell you what?"
"Who it was that my father had the affair with."
"You don't understand. Every time I see a woman my mother's age, I wonder if it was her. Luke's sister, the consul, you."
Jocelyn sighed. "It was Anna Marie Highsmith. She died in Valentine's attack on Alicante. I doubt you ever knew her."
Isabel's mouth opened, then closed again.
"I've never even heard her name before."
"Good."
Jocelyn tucked a lock of Isabel's hair back.
"Do you feel any better, now that you know?"
"Sure," Isabel lied, staring down at the ground. "I feel a lot better."
After lunch, Clary had returned to the downstairs bedroom with the excuse that she was exhausted. With the door firmly closed, she had tried contacting Simon again, though she realized, given the time difference between where she was now, Italy, and New York, there was every chance he was asleep. At least she prayed he was asleep. It was far preferable to hope for that than to consider the possibility that the rings might not work. She had been in the bedroom for only about half an hour when a knock sounded at the door. She called, "Come in." Moving to lean back on her hands, her fingers curled in as if she could hide the ring. The door swung open slowly, and Jace looked down at her from the doorway. She remembered another night, summer heat, a knock on her door. Jace, clean, in jeans and a gray shirt, his washed hair a halo of damp gold. The bruises on his face were already fading from purple to faint gray, and his hands were behind his back.
"Hey," he said.
His hands were in plain sight now, and he was wearing a soft-looking sweater, the color of bronze, that brought out the gold in his eyes. There were no bruises on his face, and the shadows she had almost grown used to seeing under his eyes were gone.
"Is he happy like this? Really happy? And if he is, what are you saving him from?" Clary pushed away the tiny voice in her head and forced a smile.
"What's up?"
He grinned. It was a wicked grin, the kind that made the blood in Clary's veins run a little faster.
"You want to go on a date?"
Caught off guard, she stammered.
What?
"A date," Jace repeated. "Often a boring thing you have to memorize in history class, but in this case, an offer of an evening of blisteringly white-hot romance with yours truly."
"Really?"
Clary was not sure what to make of this.
"Blisteringly white-hot?"
"It's me," said Jace. "Watching me play Scrabble is enough to make most women swoon. Imagine if I actually put in some effort." Clary sat up and looked down at herself. Jeans, silky green top. She thought about the cosmetics in that odd shrine-like bedroom. She couldn't help it. She was wishing for a little lip gloss. Jace held his hand out.
"You look gorgeous," he said.
"Let's go." She took his hand and let him pull her to her feet.
"I don't know."
"Come on." His voice had that self-mocking, seductive tone she remembered from when they had first been getting to know each other, when he'd brought her up to the greenhouse to show her the flower that bloomed at midnight.
"We're in Italy. Venice. One of the most beautiful cities in the world. Shame not to see it, don't you think?"
Jace pulled her forward, so she fell against his chest. The material of his shirt was soft under her fingers, and he smelled like his familiar soap and shampoo. Her heart took a sweeping dive inside her chest.
"Or we could stay in," he said, sounding a little breathless.
"So I can swoon watching you make a triple word score?" With an effort, she pulled back from him. "And spare me the jokes about scoring."
"Damn it, woman, you read my mind," he said.
"Is there no filthy wordplay you can't foresee?"
"It's my special magic power. I can read your mind when you're thinking dirty thoughts."
"So 95% of the time." She craned her head back to look at him.
95%? What's the other 5%?
"Oh, you know, the usual. Demons I might kill, runes I might need to learn, people who've annoyed me recently, people who've annoyed me not so recently. Ducks."
"Ducks?"
He waved her question away.
"All right, now watch this."
He took her shoulders and turned her gently so they were both facing the same way. A moment later, she wasn't sure how, the walls of the room seemed to melt away around them, and she found herself stepping out onto cobblestones. She gasped, turning to look behind her, and saw only a blank wall, windows high up in an old stone building. Rows of similar houses lined the canal they stood beside. If she craned her head to the left, she could see in the distance that the canal opened out into a much larger waterway, lined with grand buildings. Everywhere was the smell of water and stone.
"Cool, huh?" Jace said proudly.
She turned and looked at him.
"Ducks?" she said again.
A smile tugged the edge of his mouth.
"I hate ducks. I don't know why. I just always have."
It was early morning when Maya and Jordan arrived at the Preacher House, the headquarters of the Preacher Lupus. The truck clanked and bumped over the long white drive that swept through manicured lawns to a massive house that rose like the prow of a ship in the distance. Behind it, Maya could see strips of trees, and behind that, the blue water of the Sound some distance away.
"This is where you did your training?" she demanded.
"This place is gorgeous."
"Don't be fooled," Jordan said with a smile.
"This place is boot camp. Emphasis on the boot." She looked sideways at him. He was still smiling. He had been, pretty much nonstop, since she'd kissed him down by the beach at dawn. Part of Maya felt as if a hand had lifted her up and dropped her back into her past, when she'd loved Jordan beyond anything she'd ever imagined, and part of her felt totally adrift, as if she'd woken up in a completely foreign landscape, far from the familiarity of her everyday life and the warmth of the pack. It was very peculiar. Not bad, she thought, just peculiar. Jordan came to a stop at a circular drive in front of the house, which, up close, Maya could see was built of blocks of golden stone, the tawny color of a wolf pelt. Black double doors were set at the top of a massive stone staircase. In the center of the circular drive was a massive sundial, its raised face telling her that it was 7 in the morning. Around the edge of the sundial, words were carved. "I only mark the hours that shine." She unlocked her door and jumped down from the cab just as the doors of the house opened and a voice rang out, "Preacher Kyle!" Jordan and Maya both looked up. Descending the stairs was a middle-aged man in a charcoal suit, his blonde hair streaked with gray. Jordan, smoothing all expression from his face, turned to him. "Preacher Scott," he said, "this is Maya Roberts, of the Garraway Pack. Maya, this is Preacher Scott. He runs the Preacher Lupus, pretty much." "Since the 1800s, the Scots have always run the Preacher," said the man, glancing at Maya, who inclined her head, a sign of submission. "Jordan, I have to admit, we did not expect you back again so soon. The situation with the vampire in Manhattan, the Daylighter, is in hand," Jordan said hastily. "That's not why we're here. This concerns something quite different." Preacher Scott raised his eyebrows. "Now you've piqued my curiosity." "It's a matter of some urgency," said Maya. "Luke Garraway, our pack's leader." Preacher Scott gave her a sharp look, silencing her. Though he might have been packless, he was an alpha. That much was clear from his bearing. His eyes, under his thick eyebrows, were green-gray. Around his throat, under the collar of his shirt, sparkled the bronze pendant of the preacher with its imprint of a wolf's paw. "The preacher chooses what matters it will regard as urgent," he said. "Nor are we a hotel open to uninvited guests. Jordan took a chance in bringing you here, and he knows that. If he were not one of our most promising graduates, I might well send you both away." Jordan hooked his thumbs into the waistband of his jeans and looked at the ground. A moment later, Preacher Scott set his hand on Jordan's shoulder. "But," he said, "you are one of our most promising graduates, and you look exhausted. I can see you were up all night. Come, and we'll discuss this in my office." The office turned out to be down a long and winding hallway, elegantly paneled in dark wood. The house was lively with the sound of voices, and a sign saying, "House Rules," was pinned to the wall beside a staircase leading up. "House Rules. No shape-shifting in the hallways. No howling. No silver. Clothes must be worn at all times. All times. No fighting, no biting. Mark all your food before you put it in the communal refrigerator." The smell of cooking breakfast wafted through the air, making Maya's stomach grumble. Preacher Scott sounded amused. "I'll have someone make us up a plate of snacks if you're hungry." "Thanks," Maya muttered. They had reached the end of the hallway, and Preacher Scott opened a door marked "Office." The older werewolf's eyebrows drew together. "Rufus," he said, "what are you doing here?" Maya peered past him. The office was a large room, comfortably messy. There was a rectangular picture window that gave out onto wide lawns, on which groups of mostly young people were executing what looked like drill maneuvers, wearing black warm-up pants and tops. The walls of the room were lined with books about lycanthropy, many in Latin, but Maya recognized the word lupus. The desk was a slab of marble set upon the statues of 2 snarling wolves. In front of it were 2 chairs. In one of them sat a large man, a werewolf, hunched over, his hands gripped together.
"Preacher," he said in a grating voice, "I had hoped to speak with you regarding the incident in Boston."
"The one in which you broke your assigned charge's leg," the preacher said dryly. I will be speaking to you about it, Rufus, but not this moment. Something more pressing calls me.
That praetor.
That will be all, Rufus, said Scott, in the ringing tone of an alpha wolf whose orders were not to be challenged. Remember, this is a place of rehabilitation. Part of that is learning to respect authority. Muttering under his breath, Rufus rose from the chair. Only when he stood up did Maya realize and react to his enormous size. He towered over both her and Jordan, his black t-shirt straining over his chest, the sleeves about to split around his biceps. His head was closely shaved, his face scored with deep claw marks all across one cheek, like furrows dug in soil. He gave her a sour look as he stalked past them and out into the hall.
Of course, some of us, Jordan muttered, are easier to rehabilitate than others.
As Rufus's heavy tread faded down the hall, Scott threw himself into the high-backed chair behind the desk and buzzed a joltingly modern-looking intercom. After requesting breakfast in a terse voice, he leaned back, hands clasped behind his head.
I'm all ears, he said.
As Jordan recounted their story and their request to Praetor Scott, Maya couldn't keep her eyes and mind from wandering. She wondered what it would have been like to have been raised here, in this elegant house of rules and regulations, rather than with the comparatively lawless freedom of the pack. At some point, a werewolf dressed all in black, it seemed to be the regulation outfit of the praetor, came in with sliced roast beef, cheese, and protein drinks on a pewter tray. Maya eyed the breakfast with some dismay. It was true that werewolves needed more protein than normal people, much more. But roast beef for breakfast? You'll find, Praetor Scott said as Maya drank her protein shake gingerly, that, in fact, refined sugar is harmful to werewolves. If you cease consuming it for a period of time, you will cease desiring it. Hasn't your pack leader told you that? Maya tried to imagine Luke, who liked to make pancakes in odd and amusing shapes, lecturing her about sugar, and failed. Now was not the time to mention that, though. No, he has, of course, she said. I tend to, backslide in times of stress. I understand your concern for your pack leader, said Scott. A gold Rolex glinted on his wrist. Normally, we maintain a strict policy of non-interference regarding matters not related to new-fledged downworlders. We do not, in fact, prioritize werewolves over other downworlders, though only lycanthropes are allowed into the preacher. But that's exactly why we do need your help, said Jordan. Packs are by their nature always moving, transitional. They have no opportunity to build up things like libraries of stored knowledge. I'm not saying they don't have wisdom. But everything is an oral tradition, and every pack knows different things. We could go from pack to pack, and maybe someone would know how to cure Luke. But we don't have time. Here, he gestured at the books lining the walls, is the closest thing werewolves have to, say, the archives of the Silent Brothers, or the spiral labyrinth of the Warlocks. Scott looked unconvinced. Maya set her protein shake down. And Luke isn't just any pack leader, she said. He's the lycanthrope's representative on the council. If you help cure him, you would know that the praetor would always have a council voice in their favor. Scott's eyes glinted.
Interesting, he said.
Very well. I'll have a look through the books. It'll probably take a few hours. Jordan, I suggest that if you're going to drive back to Manhattan, you get some rest. We don't need you wrapping your truck around a tree. I could drive, Maya began. You look equally exhausted. Jordan, as you know, there will always be a room for you here at the Praetor House, even though you've graduated. And Nick is on assignment, so there's a bed for Maya. Why don't you both get some rest, and I'll call you down when I'm finished. He swiveled around in his chair to examine the books on the walls. Jordan gestured to Maya that this was their cue to leave. She stood up, brushing crumbs off her jeans. She was halfway to the door when Praetor Scott spoke again. Oh, and Maya Roberts, he said, and his voice held a note of warning. I hope you understand that when you make a promise in other people's names, it falls upon your head to make sure they follow through. Simon awoke, still feeling exhausted, blinking in the darkness. The thick black curtains over the windows let in very little light, but his internal body clock told him it was daytime. That, and the fact that Isabel was gone, her side of the bed rumpled, the covers turned back. Daytime, and he hadn't talked to Clary since she'd gone. He drew his hand out from under the covers and looked at the gold ring on his right hand. Delicate. It was etched with what were either designs or words in an alphabet he didn't know. Clenching his jaw, he sat up and touched the ring. Clary? The answer was immediate and clear. He nearly slid off the bed with relief. Simon, thank God. Can you talk? No. He felt, rather than heard, a tense distraction in the voice of her mind. I'm glad you spoke to me, but now isn't good. I'm not alone. But you're all right. I'm fine. Nothing's happened yet. I'm trying to gather information. I promise I'll talk to you the moment I hear anything. Okay, take care of yourself. You too. And she was gone. Sliding his legs over the side of the mattress, Simon did his best to flatten his sleep-mussed hair and went to see if anyone else was awake. They were. Alec, Magnus, Jocelyn, and Isabel sat around the table in Magnus's living room. While Alec and Magnus were in jeans, both Jocelyn and Isabel wore gear, Isabel with her whip wrapped around her right arm. She glanced up as he came in, but didn't smile. Her shoulders were tense, her mouth a thin line. They all had mugs of coffee in front of them. There's a reason the ritual of the mortal instruments was so complicated. Magnus made the sugar bowl float over to himself and dumped some of the white powder into his coffee. Angels act at the behest of God, not human beings, not even shadow hunters. Summon one, and you're likely to find yourself blasted with divine wrath. The whole point of the mortal instrument's ritual wasn't that it allowed someone to summon Raziel. It was that it protected the summoner from the angel's wrath once he did appear. Valentine, Alec began. Yes. Valentine also summoned a very minor angel, and it never spoke to him, did it? Never gave him a sliver of help, though he harvested its blood. And even then, he must have been using incredibly powerful spells just to bind it. My understanding is that he tied its life to the Wayland Manor, so that when the angel died, the manor collapsed to rubble. He tapped a blue painted fingernail on his mug. And he damned himself. Whether you believe in heaven and hell or not, he damned himself, surely. When he summoned Raziel, Raziel struck him down, partly in revenge for what Valentine had done to his brother Angel. Why are we talking about summoning angels? Simon asked, perching himself on the end of the long table. Isabel and Jocelyn went to see the Iron Sisters, said Alec, looking for a weapon that could be used on Sebastian that wouldn't affect Jace. And there isn't one? Nothing in this world, said Isabel. A heavenly weapon might do it, or something with a seriously demonic alliance. We were exploring the first option. Summoning up an angel to give you a weapon? It's happened before, said Magnus. Raziel gave the mortal sword to Jonathan Shadowhunter. In the old stories, the night before the Battle of Jericho, an angel appeared and gave Joshua a sword. Huh, said Simon. I would have thought angels would have been all about peace, not weapons. Magnus snorted. Angels are not just messengers. They are soldiers. Michael is said to have routed armies. They are not patient, angels. Certainly not with the vicissitudes of human beings. Anyone who tried to summon Raziel without the mortal instruments to protect them would probably be blasted to death on the spot. Demons are easier to summon. There are more of them, and many are weak. But then, a weak demon can help you only so much.
We can't summon a demon, said Jocelyn aghast. The Clave...
I thought you stopped caring what the Clave thought of you years ago, Magnus said.
It's not just me, said Jocelyn. The rest of you, Luke, my daughter.
If the Clave knew...
Well, they won't know, will they? Said Alec,
his usually gentle voice edged.
Unless you tell them.
Jocelyn looked from Isabel's still face to Magnus's inquiring one, to Alec's stubborn blue eyes.
You're really considering this? Summoning a demon?
Well, not just any demon, said Magnus.
Azazel.
Jocelyn's eyes blazed.
Azazel?
Her eyes scanned the others, as if looking for support. But Izzy and Alec glanced down at their mugs, and Simon just shrugged.
I don't know who Azazel is, he said.
Isn't he the cat from the Smurfs?
He cast about. But Isabel just looked up and rolled her eyes at him.
Clary, he thought.
Her voice came through, tinged with alarm.
What is it? What's happened? Did my mom find out I'm gone?
Not yet,
he thought back. Is Azazel the cat from the Smurfs?
There was a long pause.
That's Azrael, Simon. And no more using the magic rings for Smurf questions.
And she was gone.
Simon glanced up from his hand and saw Magnus looking at him quizzically.
He's not a cat, Sylvester, he said. He's a greater demon. Lieutenant of Hell and forger of weapons. He was an angel who taught mankind how to make weapons. When before, it had been knowledge only angels possessed. That caused him to fall, and now he is a demon. And the whole earth has been corrupted by the works that were taught by Azazel. To him ascribe all sin.
Alec looked at Magnus in amazement. How do you know all that?
He's a friend of mine, said Magnus, and noting their expressions, sighed.
Okay, not really, but it is in the Book of Enoch.
Seems dangerous, Alec frowned. It sounds like he's beyond a greater demon, even. Like Lilith.
Fortunately, he is already bound, said Magnus. If you summon him, his spirit form will come to you, but his corporeal self will remain bound to the jagged rocks of Duduel.
The jagged rocks of... Oh, whatever, Isabel said, winding her long dark hair into a bun.
He's the demon of weapons. Fine. I say we give it a go.
I can't believe you're even considering this, said Jocelyn. I learned from watching my husband what dabbling in raising demons can do.
Clary, she broke off then, as if sensing Simon's gaze on her, and turned.
Simon, she said, do you know, is Clary awake yet? We've been letting her sleep, but it's almost 11.
Simon hesitated.
I don't know.
This, he reasoned, was true. Wherever Clary was, she could be sleeping, even though he had just talked to her.
Jocelyn looked puzzled. But weren't you in the room with her?
No, I wasn't. I was...
Simon broke off, realizing the hole he'd just dug himself. There were three spare bedrooms. Jocelyn had been in one, Clary the other. Which would obviously mean he must have slept in the third room with...
Isabel?
Said Alec, his eyebrows raised.
You slept in Isabel's room?
Isabel waved a hand. No need to worry, big brother. Nothing happened.
Of course, she added as Alec's shoulders relaxed. I was totally passed out drunk, so he could really have done whatever he wanted to me, and I wouldn't have woken up.
Oh, please, said Simon. All I did was tell you the entire plot of Star Wars.
I don't think I remember that, said Isabel, taking a cookie from the plate on the table.
Oh, yeah? Who was Luke Skywalker's best childhood friend?
Biggs Darklighter, Isabel said immediately, and then hit the table with the flat of her hand.
That is so cheating!
Still, she grinned at him around her cookie.
Ah, Magnus said, nerd love. It is a beautiful thing. While also being an object of mockery and hilarity for those of us who are more sophisticated.
All right, that's enough. Jocelyn stood up. I'm going to get Clary.
If you're going to raise a demon, I don't want to be here. And I don't want my daughter to be here either. She headed toward the hallway. Simon blocked her way.
You can't do that, he said.
Jocelyn looked at him with a set face.
I know you're going to say that this is the safest place for us, Simon, but with a demon being raised,
It's not that. Simon took a deep breath, which didn't help since his blood no longer processed oxygen. He felt slightly sick.
You can't go wake her up because she isn't here.
Chapter 10 The Wild Hunt. Jordan's old room at the Preter house looked like any dormitory room at any college. There were two iron-framed beds, each set against a different wall. Through the window separating them, green lawns were visible 3 floors down. Jordan's side of the room was fairly bare. It looked as if he had taken most of his photographs and books with him to Manhattan, though there were some tacked-up pictures of beaches and the ocean, and a surfboard leaning against one wall. A little jolt went through Maya as she saw that on the bedside table was a gold-framed photo of her with Jordan, taken at Ocean City, the boardwalk and the beach behind them. Jordan looked at the photograph and then at her. He blushed. He slung his bag onto his bed and stripped off his jacket, his back to her.
When will your roommate be back? She asked into the suddenly uncomfortable silence. She wasn't sure why they were both embarrassed. They certainly hadn't been when they'd been in the truck together. But now, here in Jordan's space, the years they'd spent not speaking seemed to press them apart.
Who knows? Nick's on assignment. They're dangerous. He might not come back.
Jordan sounded resigned.
He tossed his jacket over the back of a chair.
Why don't you lie down? I'm going to take a shower.
He headed for the bathroom, which, Maya was relieved to see, was attached to his room. She didn't feel like dealing with one of those shared bathroom down the hall things.
Jordan, she began, but he'd already closed the bathroom door behind him. She could hear water running.
With a sigh, she kicked off her shoes and lay down on the absent Nick's bed. The blanket was dark blue plaid and smelled like pine cones. She looked up and saw that the ceiling was wallpapered with photographs. The same laughing blonde boy, who looked about 17, smiled down at her out of each picture. Nick, she guessed. He looked happy. Had Jordan been happy? Here at the Preter house? She reached out and flipped the photograph of the two of them toward her. It had been taken years ago, when Jordan was skinny, with big hazel eyes that dominated his face. They had their arms around each other and looked sunburned and happy. Summer had darkened both their skins and put light streaks in Maya's hair, and Jordan had his head turned slightly toward her, as if he were going to say something or kiss her. She couldn't remember which. Not anymore. She thought of the boy whose bed she was sitting on, the boy who might never come back. She thought of Luke, slowly dying, and of Alaric, and Gretel, and Justine, and Theo, and all the others of her pack who had lost their lives in the war against Valentine. She thought of Max, and of Jace, 2 Lightwoods lost, for she had to admit in her heart she didn't think they would ever get Jace back. And lastly, and strangely, she thought of Daniel, the brother she had never mourned for. And to her surprise, she felt tears sting the back of her eyes. She sat up abruptly. She felt as if the world were tilting and she was clinging on helplessly, trying to keep from tumbling into a black abyss. She could feel the shadows closing in. With Jace lost and Sebastian out there, things could only get darker. There would only be more loss and more death. She had to admit, the most alive she'd felt in weeks had been those moments at dawn, kissing Jordan in his car. As if she were in a dream, she found herself getting to her feet. She walked across the room and opened the door to the bathroom. The shower was a square of frosted glass. She could see Jordan's silhouette through it. She doubted he could hear her over the running water as she pulled off her sweater and shimmied out of her jeans and underwear. With a deep breath, she crossed the room, slid the shower door open, and stepped inside. Jordan spun around, pushing the wet hair out of his eyes. The shower was running hot, and his face was flushed, making his eyes shine as if the water had polished them. Or maybe it wasn't just the water making the blood rise under his skin as his eyes took her in. All of her. She looked back at him, steadily, not embarrassed, watching the way the Praetor Lupus pendant shone in the wet hollow of his throat, and the slide of the soap suds over his shoulders and chest as he stared at her, blinking water out of his eyes. He was beautiful. But then, she had always thought so. "Maya?" he said unsteadily. "Are you..." "Shh." She put her fingers against his lips, drawing the shower door closed with her other hand. Then she stepped closer, wrapping both arms around him, letting the water wash both of them clean of the darkness. "Don't talk. Just kiss me." So he did. "What in the name of the angel do you mean Clary isn't there?" Jocelyn demanded, white-faced. "How do you know that if you just woke up? Where is she gone?" Simon swallowed. He'd grown up with Jocelyn as almost a second mother to him. He was used to her protectiveness of her daughter. But she had always seen him as an ally in that, someone who would stand between Clary and the dangers of the world. Now she was looking at him like the enemy. "She texted me last night," Simon began, then stopped as Magnus waved him over to the table. "You might as well sit down," he said. Isabel and Alec were watching wide-eyed from either side of Magnus, but the warlock didn't look particularly surprised. "Tell us all what's going on. I have a feeling this is going to take a while." It did, though not as long as Simon might have hoped. When he was done explaining, hunched over on his chair and staring down at Magnus's scratched table, he lifted his head to see Jocelyn fixing him with a green stare as cold as Arctic water. "You let my daughter go off with Jace? To some unfindable, untraceable place where none of us can reach her?" Simon looked down at his hands. "I can reach her," he said, holding up his right hand with the gold ring on the finger. "I told you. I heard from her this morning. She said she was fine." "You never should have let her leave in the first place!" "I didn't let her. She was going to go anyway. I thought she might as well have some kind of lifeline, since it's not like I could stop her." "To be fair," said Magnus, "I don't think anyone could. Clary does what she wants." He looked at Jocelyn. "You can't keep her in a cage." "I trusted you," she snapped at Magnus. "How did she get out?" "She made a portal." "But you said there were wards." "To keep threats out, not to keep guests in." "Jocelyn, your daughter isn't stupid, and she does what she thinks is right. You can't stop her. No one can stop her. She is a great deal like her mother." Jocelyn looked at Magnus for a moment, her mouth slightly open. And Simon realized that, of course, Magnus must have known Clary's mother when she was young, when she betrayed Valentine and the Circle and nearly died in the uprising. "She's a little girl," she said, and turned to Simon. "You've spoken to her? Using these rings? Since she left?" "This morning," said Simon. "She said she was fine, that everything was fine." Instead of seeming reassured, Jocelyn only looked angrier. "I'm sure that's what she said, Simon. I can't believe you allowed her to do this. You should have restrained her." "What, tied her up?" Simon said in disbelief. "Handcuffed her to the dinner table? If that's what it took, you're stronger than she is. I'm disappointed in..." Isabel stood up. "Okay, that's enough." She glared at Jocelyn. "It is totally and completely unfair to yell at Simon over something Clary decided to do on her own. And if Simon had tied her up for you, then what? Were you planning on keeping her tied up forever? You'd have to let her go eventually. And then what? She wouldn't trust Simon anymore, and she already doesn't trust you because you stole her memories. And that, if I recall, was because you were trying to protect her. Maybe if you hadn't protected her so much, she would know more about what is dangerous and what isn't, and be a little less secretive and less reckless.
Everyone stared at Isabel. And for a moment, Simon was reminded of something that Clary had said to him once, that Izzy rarely made speeches, but when she did, she made them count. Jocelyn was white around the lips.
"I'm going to the station to be with Luke," she said. "Simon, I expect reports from you every 24 hours that my daughter is all right. If I don't hear from you every night, I'm going to the Clave." And she stalked out of the apartment, slamming the door behind her so hard that a long crack appeared in the plaster beside it. Isabel sat back down, this time beside Simon. He said nothing to her, but held out his hand, and she took it, slipping her fingers between his.
"So," Magnus said finally, breaking the silence, "who's up for raising Azazel? Because we're going to need a whole lot of candles."
Jason Clary spent the day wandering through maze-like tiny streets that ran along canals whose water ranged from deep green to murky blue. They made their way among the tourists in St. Mark's Square and over the Bridge of Sighs and drank small, powerful cups of espresso at Café Florian. The disorienting maze of streets reminded Clary a bit of Alicante, though Alicante lacked Venice's feeling of elegant decay. There were no roads here. No cars, only twisting little alleys and bridges arching over canals whose water was as green as malachite. As the sky overhead darkened to the deep blue of late autumn twilight, lights began to go on in tiny boutiques and bars and restaurants that seemed to appear out of nowhere and disappear again into shadow as she and Jace passed, leaving light and laughter behind. When Jace asked Clary if she was ready for dinner, she nodded firmly yes. She had begun to feel guilty that she had gotten no information out of him, and that she was actually enjoying herself. As they crossed over a bridge to the Dorso d'Oro, one of the quieter sections of the city, away from the tourist throng, she determined that she was going to get something out of him that night, something worth relaying to Simon. Jace held her hand firmly as they went over a final bridge and the street opened out into a great square on the side of an enormous canal the size of a river. The basilica of a domed church rose on their right. Across the canal, more of the city lit the evening, throwing illumination onto the water, which shifted and glimmered with light. Clary's hands itched for chalk and pencils, to draw the light as it faded out of the sky. The darkening water, the jagged outlines of the buildings, the reflection slowly dimming in the canal. Everything seemed washed with a steely blueness. Somewhere, church bells were chiming. She tightened her hand on Jace's. She felt very far away here, from everything in her life, distant in a way that she had not felt in Idris. Venice shared with Alicante the sense of being a place out of time, torn from the past, as if she had stepped into a painting or the pages of a book. But it was also a real place, one she had grown up knowing about, wanting to visit. She looked sidelong at Jace, who was gazing down the canal. The steely blue light was on him, too, darkening his eyes, the shadows under his cheekbones, the lines of his mouth. When he caught her gaze on him, he looked over and smiled. He led her around the church and down a flight of mossy steps to a path along the canal. Everything smelled of wet stone and water and dampness and years. As the sky darkened, something broke the surface of the canal water a few feet from Clary. She heard the splash and looked in time to see a green-haired woman rise from the water and grin at her. She had a beautiful face, but shark-like teeth and a fish's yellow eyes. Pearls were wound through her hair. She sank again below the water without a ripple.
"Mermaid," said Jace. "There are old families of them that have lived here in Venice a long, long time. They're a little odd. They do better in clean water, far out to sea, living on fish instead of garbage. He looked toward the sunset. The whole city is sinking, he said. It'll all be underwater in 100 years. Imagine swimming down into the ocean and touching the top of St. Mark's Basilica. He pointed across the water. Clary felt a flicker of sadness at the thought of all of this beauty being lost. Isn't there anything they can do? To raise a whole city? Or hold back the ocean? Not much, said Jace. They had come to a set of stairs leading up. The wind came off the water and lifted his dark gold hair off his forehead, his neck. All things tend toward entropy. The whole universe is moving outward. The stars pulling away from one another. God knows what falling through the cracks between them. He paused. Okay, that sounded a little crazy. Maybe it was all the wine at lunch. I can hold my liquor. They turned a corner, and a fairyland of lights gleamed out at them. Clary blinked, her eyes adjusting. It was a small restaurant with tables set outside and inside, heat lamps wound with Christmas lights like a forest of magical trees between the tables. Jace detached himself from her long enough to get them a table, and soon they were sitting by the side of the canal, listening to the splash of water against stone and the sound of small boats bobbing up and down with the tide. Tiredness was beginning to wash over Clary in waves, like the lap of water against the sides of the canal. She told Jace what she wanted and let him order an Italian, relieved when the waiter went away so she could lean forward and rest her elbows on the table, her head on her hands. I think I have jet lag, she said. Interdimensional jet lag. You know, time is a dimension, Jace said. Pedant. She flicked a breadcrumb from the basket on the table at him. He grinned. I was trying to remember all the deadly sins the other day, he said. Greed, envy, gluttony, irony, pedantry. I'm pretty sure irony isn't a deadly sin. I'm pretty sure it is. Lust, she said. Lust is a deadly sin. And spanking. I think that falls under lust. I think it should have its own category, said Jace. Greed, envy, gluttony, irony, pedantry, lust, and spanking. The white Christmas lights were reflected in his eyes. He looked more beautiful than he ever had, Clary thought, and correspondingly more distant, more hard to touch. She thought of what he had said about the city sinking, and the spaces between the stars, and remembered the lines of a Leonard Cohen song that Simon's band used to cover, not very well. There is a crack in everything. That's how the light gets in. There had to be a crack in Jace's calm. Some way she could reach through to the real him she believed was still in there. Jace's amber eyes studied her. He reached out to touch her hand, and it was only after a moment that Clary realized that his fingers were on her gold ring. What's that? He said. I don't remember you having a fairy work ring. His tone was neutral, but her heart skipped a beat. Lying straight to Jace's face wasn't something she had a lot of practice with. It was Isabel's, she said with a shrug. She was throwing out all the stuff that fairy ex-boyfriend of hers gave her, Meliorn, and I thought this was pretty, so she said I could have it. And the Morgenstern ring? This seemed like a place to tell the truth. I gave it to Magnus, so he could try to track you with it. Magnus. Jace said the name as if it were a stranger's and exhaled a breath. Do you still feel like you made the right decision? Coming with me here? Yes. I'm happy to be with you. And, well, I always wanted to see Italy. I've never traveled much. Never been out of the country. You were in Alicante, he reminded her. Okay, other than visiting magical lands no one else can see, I haven't traveled much. Simon and I had plans. We were going to go backpacking around Europe after we graduated high school. Clary's voice trailed off. It sounds silly now. No, it doesn't. He reached out and pushed a strand of hair behind her ear.
Stay with me. We can see the whole world.
I am with you. I'm not going anywhere.
Is there anything special you want to see?
Paris? Budapest? The Leaning Tower of Pisa?
Only if it falls on Sebastian's head, she thought.
Can we travel to Idris? Can the apartment travel there?
It can't get past the wards.
His hand traced a path down her cheek.
You know, I really missed you.
You mean you haven't been going on romantic dates with Sebastian while you've been away from me?
I tried, Jace said. But no matter how liquored up you get him, he just won't put out.
Clary reached for her glass of wine. She was starting to get used to the taste of it. She could feel it burning a path down her throat, heating her veins, adding a dreamlike quality to the night. She was in Italy, with her beautiful boyfriend, on a beautiful night, eating delicious food that melted in her mouth. These were the kinds of moments that you remembered all your life. But it felt like touching only the edge of happiness. Every time she looked at Jace, happiness slipped away from her.
How could he be Jace and not Jace all at once?
How could you be heartbroken and happy at the same time? They lay in the narrow twin bed that was meant for only one person, wrapped together tightly under Jordan's flannel sheet. Maya lay with her head in the crook of his arm, the sun from the window warming her face and shoulders. Jordan was propped on his arm, leaning over her, his free hand running through her hair, pulling her curls out to their full length and letting them slide back through his fingers.
I missed your hair, he said, and dropped a kiss onto her forehead.
Laughter bubbled up from somewhere deep inside her, that sort of laughter that came with the giddiness of infatuation.
Just my hair?
No. He was grinning, his hazel eyes lit with green, his brown hair thoroughly rumpled.
Your eyes?
He kissed them, one after another.
Your mouth?
He kissed that, too. And she hooked her fingers through the chain against his bare chest that held the Praetor Lupus pendant.
Everything about you.
She twisted the chain around her fingers.
Jordan, I'm sorry about before, about snapping at you about the money and Stanford. It was just a lot to take in.
His eyes darkened, and he ducked his head.
It's not like I don't know how independent you are. I wanted to do something nice for you.
I know, she whispered.
I know you worry about me needing you, but I shouldn't be with you because I need you. I should be with you because I love you.
His eyes lit up, incredulous, hopeful.
You think it's possible you could feel that way about me again?
I never stopped loving you, Jordan, she said. And he caught her against him with a kiss so intense it was bruising. She moved closer to him, and things might have proceeded as they had in the shower if a sharp knock hadn't come at the door.
Praetor Kyle! A voice shouted through the door. Wake up! Praetor Scott wishes to see you downstairs in his office.
Jordan, his arms around Maya, swore softly. Laughing, Maya ran her hand slowly up his back, tangling her fingers in his hair.
Do you think Praetor Scott can wait? She whispered.
I think he has a key to this room and he'll use it if he feels like it.
That's all right, she said, brushing her lips against his ear. We have lots of time, right? All the time we'll ever need.
Chairman Meow lay on the table in front of Simon, completely asleep, his four legs sticking straight into the air. This, Simon felt, was something of an achievement. Since he had become a vampire, animals tended not to like him. They avoided him if they could, and hissed or barked if he came too close. For Simon, who had always been an animal lover, it was a hard loss. But he supposed, if you were already the pet of a warlock, perhaps you'd learn to accept weird creatures in your life.
Magnus, as it turned out, hadn't been joking about the candles. Simon was taking a moment to rest and drink some coffee. It stayed down well, and the caffeine took the edge off the beginning prickles of hunger. All afternoon, they had been helping Magnus set the scene for raising Azazel. They had raided local bodegas for tea lights and prayer candles, which they had placed in a careful circle. Isabel and Alec were scattering the floorboards outside the circle with a mixture of salt and dried belladonna as Magnus instructed them, reading aloud from Forbidden Rites, a necromancer's manual of the 15th century. "What have you done to my cat?" Magnus demanded, returning to the living room carrying a pot of coffee with a circle of mugs floating around his head like a model of the planets rotating around the sun. "You drank his blood, didn't you? You said you weren't hungry!" Simon was indignant. "I did not drink his blood. He's fine." He poked the chairman in the stomach. The cat yawned. "Second, you asked me if I was hungry when you were ordering pizza, so I said no, because I can't eat pizza. I was being polite. That doesn't give you the right to eat my cat." "Your cat is fine!" Simon reached to pick up the tabby, who jumped indignantly to his feet and stalked off the table. "See? Whatever." Magnus threw himself down in the seat at the head of the table. The mugs banged into place as Alec and Izzy straightened up, done with their task. Magnus clapped his hands. "Everyone, gather round. It's time for a meeting. I'm going to teach you how to summon a demon." Preeter Scott was waiting for them in the library. Still in the same swivel chair, a small bronze box on the desk between them. Maya and Jordan sat down across from him, and Maya couldn't help wondering if it was written all over her face, what she and Jordan had been doing. Not that the preacher was looking at them with much interest. He pushed the box toward Jordan. "It's a salve," he said. "If applied to Garraway's wound, it should filter the poison from his blood and allow the demon's steel to work its way free. He should heal in a few days." Maya's heart leaped. Finally, some good news. She reached for the box before Jordan could and opened it. It smelled sharply herbal, like crushed bay leaves. Preeter Scott began, his eyes flicking to Jordan. "She should take it," said Jordan. "She's close to Garraway and is part of the pack. They trust her."
"Are you saying they don't trust the Preeter?"
"Half of them think the Preeter is a fairy tale," Maya said, adding, "sir," as an afterthought. Preeter Scott looked annoyed. But before he could say anything, the phone on his desk rang. He seemed to hesitate, then lifted the receiver to his ear. "Scott here," he said, and then, after a moment, "Yes, yes, I think so." He hung up, his mouth curving into a not entirely pleasant smile. "Preeter Kyle," he said. "I'm glad you dropped in on us today, of all days. Stay a moment. This matter somewhat concerns you." Maya was startled at this pronouncement, but not as startled as she was a moment later when a corner of the room began to shimmer and a figure appeared, slowly developing. It was like watching images appear on film in a dark room, and the figure of a young boy took shape. His hair was dark brown, short and straight, and a gold necklace gleamed against the brown skin of his throat. He looked slight and ethereal, like a choir boy, but there was something in his eyes that made him seem much older than that. "Raphael," she said, recognizing him. He was ever so slightly transparent. A projection, she realized. She'd heard of them, but had never seen one up close. Preeter Scott looked at her in surprise. "You know the head of the New York vampire clan?"
"We met once, in Brosseland Woods," said Raphael, looking her over without much interest.
"She is a friend of the Daylighter, Simon."
"Your assignment," Preeter Scott said to Jordan, as if Jordan could have forgotten.
Jordan's forehead creased. "Has something happened to him?" he asked.
"Is he all right?"
"This is not about him," said Raphael. "It is about the rogue vampire, Maureen Brown."
"Maureen?" Maya exclaimed. "But she's only,
What, 13?
A rogue vampire is a rogue vampire, said Raphael. And Maureen has been cutting quite a swath for herself through Tribeca and the Lower East Side. Multiple injured and at least 6 kills. We've managed to cover them up, but... She's Nick's assignment, said Preeter Scott with a frown. But he hasn't been able to find a trace of her. We may need to send someone with more experience.
I urge you to do so, said Raphael.
If the Shadow Hunters were not so concerned with their own emergency at this juncture, they would surely have involved themselves by now. And the last thing the clan needs after the affair with Camille is a censuring by the Shadow Hunters.
I take it Camille is still missing as well, said Jordan.
Simon told us everything that happened the night Jace disappeared, and Maureen seemed to be doing Camille's bidding.
Camille is not new maid, and is therefore not our concern, said Scott.
I know, but find her, and you may find Maureen. That's all I'm saying, said Jordan.
If she were with Camille, she would not be killing at the rate she is, said Raphael.
Camille would prevent her. She's bloodthirsty, but she knows the Conclave and the law. She would keep Maureen and her activities out of their line of sight.
No, Maureen's behavior has all the hallmarks of a vampire gone feral.
Then I think you're right. Jordan sat back. Nick should have backup in dealing with her, or something might happen to him.
If it does, perhaps it will help you focus more in future, said Preeter Scott.
On your own assignment.
Jordan's mouth opened.
Simon wasn't responsible for turning Maureen, he said. I told you.
Preeter Scott waved away his words.
Yes, I know, he said. Or you would have been pulled from your assignment, Kyle. But your subject did bite her, and under your watch as well. And it was her association with the Daylighter, however distant, that led to her eventual turning.
The Daylighter is dangerous, said Raphael, his eyes shining. It is what I have been saying all along.
He is not dangerous, Maya said fiercely. He has a good heart.
She saw Jordan glance at her a little, sidelong, so quickly that she wondered if she'd imagined it.
Yep, 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 said Raphael dismissively. You werewolves cannot focus on the matter at hand. I trusted you, Preeter, for new-fledged downworlders are your department. But allowing Maureen to run wild reflects badly on my clan. If you do not find her soon, I will call up every vampire at my disposal. After all, he smiled, and his delicate incisors shone. In the end, she is ours to kill.
When the meal was over, Clary and Jace walked back to the apartment through a mist-shrouded evening. The streets were deserted and the canal waters shone like glass. Rounding a corner, they found themselves beside a quiet canal, lined with shuttered houses. Boats bobbed gently on the curving water, each a half-moon of black. Jace laughed softly and moved forward, his hand pulling out of Clary's. His eyes were wide and golden in the lamplight. He knelt by the side of the canal, and she saw a flash of white silver, a steely, and then one of the boats sprang free of its mooring chain and began to drift toward the center of the canal. Jay slid the steely back into his belt and leaped, landing lightly on the wooden seat at the front of the boat. He held his hand out to Clary.
Come on.
She looked from him to the boat and shook her head. It was only a little bigger than a canoe, painted black, though the paint was damp and splintering. It looked as light and fragile as a toy. She imagined upending it and both of them being dumped into the ice-green canal.
I can't. I'll knock it over.
Jay shook his head impatiently.
You can do it, he said. I trained you.
To demonstrate, he took a step back. Now he was standing on the thin edge of the boat, just beside the oarlock. He looked at her, his mouth crooked in a half-smile. By all the laws of physics, she thought, the boat, unbalanced, ought to have been toppling sideways into the water. But Jace balanced lightly there, back straight, as if he were made of nothing more than smoke. Behind him was the backdrop of water and stone, canal and bridges, not a single modern edifice in sight. With his bright hair and the way he carried himself, he could have been some Renaissance prince. He held out a hand to her again.
"Remember, you're as light as you want to be."
She remembered. Hours of training in how to fall, to balance, how to land like Jace did, as if you were a piece of ash sifting gently downward. She sucked her breath in and leaped, the green water flying by beneath her. She alighted in the bow of the boat, wobbling on the wooden seat, but steady. She let out her breath in a whoosh of relief and heard Jace laugh as he leaped down to the flat bottom of the boat. It was leaky. A thin layer of water covered the wood. He was also 9 inches taller than she was, so that with her standing on the seat in the bow, their heads were on a level. He put his hands on her waist.
"So," he said, "where do you want to go now?"
She looked around. They had drifted far away from the bank of the canal.
"Are we stealing this boat?"
"Stealing is such an ugly word," he mused.
"What do you want to call it?"
He picked her up and swung her around before putting her down.
"An extreme case of window shopping."
He pulled her closer, and she stiffened. Her feet skidded out from under her, and the two of them slid to the curved floor of the boat, which was flat and damp and smelled like water and wet wood. Clary found herself resting on top of Jace, her knees on either side of his hips. Water was soaking into his shirt, but he didn't seem to mind. He threw his hands behind his head, folding them, his shirt pulling up.
"You literally knocked me down with the strength of your passion," he observed.
"Nice work, Frey."
"You only fell because you wanted to. I know you," she said.
The moon shone down on them like a spotlight, like they were the only people under it.
"You never slip."
He touched her face.
"I may not slip," he said. "But I fall."
Her heart pounded, and she had to swallow before she could reply lightly, as if he were joking.
"That may be your worst line of all time."
"Who says it's a line?" The boat rocked, and she leaned forward, balancing her hands on his chest, her hips pressed against his, and she watched his eyes as they widened, going from wickedly sparkling gold to dark, the pupils swallowing the iris. She could see herself and the night sky in them. He propped himself up on one elbow and slipped a hand around the back of her neck. She felt him arch up against her, lips brushing hers, but she drew back, not quite allowing the kiss. She wanted him so much she felt hollow on the inside, as if desire had burned her clean through. No matter what her mind said, that this was not Jace, not her Jace. Still her body remembered him, the shape and feel of him, the scent of his skin and hair, and wanted him back. She smiled against his mouth as if she were teasing him, and rolled to the side, curling next to him in the wet bottom of the boat. He didn't protest. His arm curved around her, and the rocking of the boat beneath them was gentle and lulling. She wanted to put her head on his shoulder, but didn't.
"We're drifting," she said.
"I know.
There's something I want you to see."
Jace was looking up at the sky. The moon was a great white billow, like a sail. Jace's chest rose and fell steadily, his fingers tangled in her hair. She lay still beside him, waiting and watching as the stars ticked by like an astrological clock, and she wondered what they were waiting for. At last she heard it. A long, slow, rushing noise, like water pouring through a broken dam. The sky darkened and churned as figures rushed across it. She could barely make them out through the clouds in the distance, but they seemed to be men, with long hair like cirrus clouds, riding horses whose hooves gleamed the color of blood. The sound of a hunting horn echoed across the night, and the stars shivered and the night folded in on itself as the men vanished behind the moon. She let her breath out in a slow exhalation.
"What was that?"
"The wild hunt," said Jace. His voice sounded distant and dreamlike. "Gabriel's hounds, the wild host.
They have many names. They are fairies who disdain the earthly courts. They ride across the sky, pursuing an eternal hunt. On one night a year, a mortal can join them. But once you've joined the hunt, you can never leave it. Why would anyone want to do that? Jace rolled and was suddenly on top of Clary, pressing her down into the bottom of the boat. She hardly noticed the damp. She could feel heat rolling off him in waves, and his eyes burned. He had a way of propping himself over her so that she wasn't crushed, but she could feel every part of him against her. The shape of his hips, the rivets in his jeans, the tracings of his scars. "There's something appealing about the idea," he said, "of losing all your control. Don't you think?" She opened her mouth to answer, but he was already kissing her. She had kissed him so many times, soft, gentle kisses, hard and desperate ones, brief brushes of the lips that said goodbye, and kisses that seemed to go on for hours. And this was no different. The way the memory of someone who had once lived in a house might linger even after they were gone, like a sort of psychic imprint. Her body remembered Jace, remembered the way he tasted, the slant of his mouth over hers, his scars under her fingers, the shape of his body under her hands. She let go of her doubts and reached up to pull him toward her. He rolled sideways, holding her, the boat rocking underneath them. Clary could hear the splash of water as his hands drifted down her side to her waist, his fingers lightly stroking the sensitive skin at the small of her back. She slid her hands into his hair and closed her eyes, wrapped in mist, the sound and smell of water. Endless ages went by, and there was only Jace's mouth on hers, the lulling motion of the boat, his hands on her skin. Finally, after what could have been hours or minutes, she heard the sound of someone shouting, an angry Italian voice rising and cutting through the night. Jace drew back, his look lazy and regretful. "We'd better go." Clary looked up at him, dazed. "Why?" "Because that's the guy whose boat we stole." Jace sat up, tugging his shirt down. "And he's about to call the police." Chapter 11. Ascribe All Sin. Magnus said that no electricity could be used during the summoning of Azazel, so the loft apartment was lit only by candlelight. The candles burned in a circle in the center of the room, all different heights and brightness, though they shared a similar blue-white flame. Inside the circle, a pentagram had been drawn by Magnus, using a rowan stick that had burned the pattern of overlapping triangles into the floor. In between the spaces formed by the pentagram were symbols unlike anything Simon had seen before. Not quite letters, and not quite runes. They gave off a chilly sense of menace, despite the heat of the candle flames. It was dark outside the windows now, the sort of dark that came with the early sunsets of approaching winter. Isabel, Alec, Simon, and finally Magnus, who was chanting aloud from forbidden rites, each stood at one cardinal point around the circle. Magnus's voice rose and fell, the Latin words like a prayer, but one that was inverted and sinister. The flames rose higher, and the symbols carved into the floor began to burn black. Chairman Meow, who had been watching from a corner of the room, hissed and fled into the shadows. The blue-white flames rose, and now Simon could hardly see Magnus through them. The room was getting hotter, the warlock chanting faster, his black hair curling in the humid heat, sweat gleaming on his cheekbones. "Quod tumereris per Jehovam, gehenem et consecratum, aquam quam nunc spargo, signumque crucis quod nunc facio, et per vota nostra, ipse nunc surgat nobis decadis Azazel." There was a burst of fire from the center of the pentagram, and a thick black wave of smoke rose, dissipating slowly through the room, making everyone but Simon cough and choke.
It swirled like a whirlpool, coalescing slowly in the center of the pentagram into the figure of a man. Simon blinked. He wasn't sure what he'd expected, but it wasn't this. A tall man with auburn hair, neither young nor old, an ageless face, inhuman and cold, broad-shouldered, dressed in a well-cut black suit and shining black shoes. Around each wrist was a dark red groove, the marks of some sort of binding, rope, or metal that had cut into the skin over many years. In his eyes were leaping red flames. He spoke.
"Whom summons Azazel?"
His voice was like metal grinding on metal.
"I do." Magnus firmly shut the book he was holding. "Magnus Bane."
Azazel craned his head slowly toward Magnus. His head seemed to swivel unnaturally on his neck, like the head of a snake.
"Warlock," he said. "I know who you are."
Magnus raised his eyebrows.
"You do?"
"Summoner, binder, destroyer of the demon Marbus, son of..."
"Now," said Magnus quickly. "There's no need to get into all of that."
"But there is."
Azazel sounded reasonable, even amused.
"If it is infernal assistance you require, why not summon your father?"
Alec was looking at Magnus with his mouth open. Simon felt for him. He didn't think any of them had ever assumed that Magnus even knew who his father was, beyond that he had been a demon who had tricked his mother into believing he was her husband. Alec clearly knew no more about it than the rest of them, which, Simon imagined, was probably something he wasn't too happy about. "My father and I are not on the best of terms," said Magnus. "I would prefer not to involve him." Azazel raised his hands.
"As you say, master. You hold me within the seal. What do you demand?"
Magnus said nothing, but it was clear from the expression on Azazel's face that the warlock was speaking to him silently, mind to mind. The flames leaped and danced in the demon's eyes like eager children listening to a story.
"Clever, Lilith,"
the demon said at last,
"to raise the boy from death and secure his life by binding him to someone whom you cannot bear to kill. She was always better at manipulating human emotions than most of the rest of us. Perhaps because she was something close to human once."
"Is there a way," Magnus sounded impatient, "to break the bond between them?" Azazel shook his head.
"Not without killing them both."
"Then, is there a way to harm Sebastian only, without hurting Jace?" It was Isabel, eager. Magnus shot her a quelling look.
"Not with any weapon I might create, or have at my disposal," said Azazel. "I can craft only weapons whose alliance is demonic. A bolt of lightning from the hand of an angel, perhaps, might burn away what was evil in Valentine's son, and either break their tie or cause it to become more benevolent in nature. If I might make a suggestion..."
"Oh," said Magnus, narrowing his cat's eyes. "Please do."
"I can think of a simple solution that will separate the boys, keep yours alive, and neutralize the danger of the other one. And I will ask very little of you in return."
"You are my servant," Magnus said. "If you wish to leave this pentagram, you will do what I ask, and not demand favors in return." Azazel hissed, and fire curled from his lips.
"If I am not bound here, then I am bound there. It makes little difference to me."
"For this is hell, nor am I out of it," said Magnus, with the air of someone quoting an old saying. Azazel showed a metallic smile.
"You may not be proud like old Faustus, warlock, but you are impatient. I am sure my willingness to remain in this pentagram will outlast your desire to keep watch over me inside it."
Oh, I don't know, Magnus said. I've always been fairly bold where decorating is concerned, and having you here does add that little extra touch of something to the room.
Magnus, Alex said, clearly not thrilled at the idea of an immortal demon taking up residence in his boyfriend's loft.
Jealous, little shadow hunter?
Azazel grinned at Alec.
Your warlock is not my type, and besides, I would hardly want to anger his...
Enough, Magnus said. Tell us what the little thing you want in return for your plan is. Azazel templed his hands. Hard workman's hands, the color of blood, topped with black nails.
One happy memory, he said, from each of you. Something to amuse me while I'm bound like Prometheus to his rock.
A memory? Said Isabel in astonishment. You mean it would vanish out of our heads? We wouldn't be able to recall it anymore? Azazel squinted at her through the flames.
What are you, little one? A Nephilim? Yes, I would take your memory and it would become mine. You would no longer know that it had happened to you. Although, please do avoid giving me memories of demons you've slaughtered under the light of the moon. Not the sort of thing I enjoy. No, I want these memories to be... personal.
He grinned, and his teeth gleamed like an iron portcullis. I'm old, Magnus said. I have many memories. I would give one up, if needed. But I cannot speak for the rest of you. No one should be forced to give up something like this. I'll do it, Isabel said immediately. For Jace. I will too, of course, said Alec. And then it was Simon's turn. He thought suddenly of Jace, cutting his wrist and giving him his blood in the tiny room on Valentine's boat, risking his own life for Simon's. It might have been for Clary's sake at its heart, but it was still a debt. I'm in. Good, Magnus said. All of you, try to think of happy memories. They must be genuinely happy. Something that gives you pleasure in the recollection. He shot a sour glance at the smug demon in the pentagram. I'm ready, Isabel said. She was standing with her eyes closed, her back straight as if braced for pain. Magnus moved toward her and laid his fingers against her forehead, murmuring softly. Alec watched Magnus with his sister, his mouth tight, then shut his eyes. Simon shut his own, too, hastily, and tried to summon up a happy memory. Something to do with Clary? But so many of his memories of her were tinged now with his worry over her well-being. Something from when they were very young? An image swam to the forefront of his mind. A hot summer day at Coney Island, him on his father's shoulders, Rebecca running behind them, trailing a handful of balloons, looking up at the sky, trying to find shapes in the clouds, and the sound of his mother's laughter. No, he thought, not that. I don't want to lose that. There was a cool touch on his forehead. He opened his eyes and saw Magnus lowering his hand. Simon blinked at him, his mind suddenly blank. But I wasn't thinking of anything, he protested. Magnus's cat eyes were sad. Yes, you were. Simon glanced around the room, feeling a little dizzy. The others looked the same, as if they were awakening from a strange dream. He caught Isabel's eye, the dark flutter of her lashes, and wondered what she had thought about, what happiness she had given away. A low rumble from the center of the pentagram drew his gaze from Izzy. Azazel stood, as close to the edge of the pattern as he could, the slow growl of hunger coming from his throat. Magnus turned and looked at him, a look of disgust on his face. His hands were closed into fists, and something seemed to be shining between his fingers, as if he held a witch-light runestone. He turned and flung it fast and sideways into the center of the pentagram. Simon's vampire vision tracked it. It was a bead of light that expanded as it flew, expanded into a circle holding multiple images. Simon saw a piece of an azure ocean, the corner of a satin dress that belled out as its wearer spun.
a glimpse of Magnus's face, a boy with blue eyes. And then Azazel opened his arms, and the circle of images vanished into his body, like a stray piece of trash sucked into the fuselage of a jet plane. Azazel gasped. His eyes, which had been darting flickers of red flame, blazed like bonfires now, and his voice crackled when he spoke.
Ah, delicious.
Magnus spoke sharply. Now for your side of the bargain. The demon licked his lips.
The solution to your problem is this. You release me into the world, and I take Valentine's son and bring him living into hell. He will not die, and therefore your Jace will live, but he will have left this world behind, and slowly their connection will burn away. You will have your friend back.
And then what? Magnus said slowly. We release you into the world, and then you return and let yourself be bound again? Azazel laughed.
Of course not, foolish warlock. The price for the favor is my freedom.
Freedom? Alex spoke, sounding incredulous. A prince of hell, set free in the world? We already gave you our memories.
The memories were the price you paid to hear my plan, said Azazel. My freedom is what you will pay to have my plan enacted.
That is a cheat, and you know it, said Magnus. You ask for the impossible.
So do you, said Azazel. By all rights, your friend is lost to you forever. For if a man vow a vow unto the Lord, or swear an oath to bind his soul with a bond, he shall not break his word. And by the terms of Lilith's spell, their souls are bound, and both agreed.
Jace would never agree, Alec began.
He said the words, said Azazel. Of his own will or under compunction, it does not matter. You are asking me to sever a bond only heaven can sever. But heaven will not help you. You know that as well as I. That is why men summon demons and not angels, is it not? This is the price you pay for my intervention. If you do not want to pay it, you must learn to accept what you've lost.
Magnus's face was pale and tight. We will converse among ourselves and discuss whether your offer is acceptable. In the meantime, I banish you. He waved his hand, and Azazel vanished, leaving behind the smell of charred wood. The four people in the room stared at one another incredulously. What he is asking for, Alex said finally. It isn't possible, is it? Theoretically, anything is possible, said Magnus, staring ahead as if into an abyss. But to loose a greater demon on the world, not just a greater demon, a prince of hell, second only to Lucifer himself? The destruction he could wreak. Isn't it possible, Isabel said, that Sebastian could wreak just as much destruction? Like Magnus said, Simon put in bitterly, anything's possible. There could be almost no greater crime in the eyes of the Clave, said Magnus. Whoever loosed Azazel upon the world would be a wanted criminal. But if we're to destroy Sebastian, Isabel began. We don't have proof Sebastian's plotting anything, said Magnus. For all we know, all he wants is to settle down in a nice country house in Idris. With Clary and Jace? Alex said incredulously. Magnus shrugged. Who knows what he wants with them? Maybe he's just lonely. No way did he kidnap Jace off that roof because he's desperately in need of a bromance, said Isabel. He's planning something. They all looked at Simon. Clary's trying to find out what. She needs some time. And don't say we don't have time, he added. She knows that. Alec raked a hand through his dark hair. Fine. But we just wasted a whole day. A day we didn't have. No more stupid ideas. His voice was uncharacteristically sharp. Alec, Magnus said. He put a hand on his boyfriend's shoulder. Alec was standing still, staring angrily at the floor. "Are you okay?" Alec looked at him. "Who are you again?" Magnus gave a little gasp. He looked for the first time Simon could remember, actually unnerved. It lasted only a moment, but it was there. "Alexander," he said. "Too soon to joke about the happy memory thing, I take it," Alec said. "You think?" Magnus's voice soured. Before he could say anything else, the door swung open, and Maya and Jordan came in. Their cheeks were red from the cold, and Simon saw with a small start Maya was wearing Jordan's leather jacket. "We just came from the station," she said excitedly. "Luke hasn't woken up yet, but it looks like he's going to be all right." She broke off, looking around at the still glimmering pentagram, the clouds of black smoke, and the scorched patches on the floor. "Okay. What have you guys been doing?"